Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box.
And I'm Adam Glick. Well, it's great to be here in San Diego and actually to be here in person.
Yes, it's one of those rare occasions where we are both in the same room talking to one another.
It is going to be quite a busy week. Pretty excited for the start of KubeCon, which has kicked off today, and we have a ton of news to cover.
Let's get straight into it.
Docker shook the container industry this week by announcing that it was retooling as a developer company and selling its enterprise software business. First, Mirantis announced the acquisition of Docker's enterprise business, including 750 customers and 300 engineers, for an undisclosed sum. Docker then followed by announcing a $35 million cash injection, a renewed focus on Docker Desktop and Docker Hub, and a new CEO, the previous chief product officer, Scott Johnson. Mirantis also announced a beta release of their Kubernetes as a service offering called Mirantis CAS, that's with a K. The new offering covers bare metal, edge, on-prem, public, and private clouds.
Google Cloud made a number of announcements relating to GKE this week. Preemptible VM nodes, vertical pod autoscaling, and node auto-provisioning are all now GA, a potent combination for running batch workloads. To that end, a preview of batch on GKE brings the functionality and familiarity of a traditional batch job scheduler to Kubernetes, freeing applications from the limitations of fixed-size clusters by dynamically allocating resources. Also launched in beta was Surge Upgrades, a facility to allow adding extra nodes faster during cluster upgrades. Google says Surge Upgrades will reduce disruption to customer workloads and can drastically reduce the time it takes to upgrade a large node pool. Announcements about Google Cloud's Anthos are being made at Next UK later this week.
Cloud Run, a fully managed Knative service from Google Cloud, is now GA. It comes in two flavors. Google Cloud Run is a serverless execution environment that lets you run stateless containers without worrying about the infrastructure. Cloud Run for Anthos lets you deploy those same applications into a private Anthos GKE cluster running either on-prem or in GCP. You can also take these applications and run them on any Knative service of your own choosing.
Microsoft made a number of announcements in the last week. The open-source AKS engine tool for deploying unmanaged Kubernetes is getting preview support for deploying pods to secure enclaves such as those provided by Intel SGX. Microsoft said that this feature may eventually be added to managed AKS if it proves popular. The Azure Container Registry has added repository scope permissions, and the Kubernetes event-driven autoscaling project has hit 1.0. Finally, Microsoft announced GitHub Action support for publishing CNAB bundles and a CNAB operator that runs on Kubernetes clusters to pull down and deploy those bundles from a repository. You can learn about CNAB in episode 61.
The Helm team has announced the long-awaited stable release of Helm 3. Helm is a package manager for Kubernetes, and version 3 removes the tiller component, which previously ran as root in the cluster. Other enhancements in the release include a new Go SDK and experimental support for OCI distribution images.
The Istio team has announced the release of Istio 1.4, the latest quarterly release. Version 1.4 continues improving the Istio user experience with a focus on simplification. There are also new features that improve the performance and experience of running Istio. GitHub this week announced that Istio was in the top 5 fastest growing open source projects hosted on that site, and the highest ranked cloud native project in that category.
If you're using container storage interface drivers, be aware there has been a security release that impacts most versions of the sidecars bundled with those drivers. The vulnerabilities are medium severity and can result in unauthorized volume data access or mutation when using the volume snapshot, cloning, or resizing features in Kubernetes. Upgrading your CSI drivers to the fixed sidecars is recommended.
Red Hat announced the Quay Container Registry, started in 2013 and acquired with their CoreOS acquisition in January 2018, has been open-sourced. The new project Quay, with a Q and an odd pronunciation, will be the open-source upstream of both Red Hat's commercial Quay product and the public registry, Quay.io. The project also includes the Clair Security Scanner. Red Hat also announced version 2 of Code Ready Workspaces, their Kubernetes-based IDE for OpenShift. V2 adds air-gapped installation, shareable developer workspaces, support for VS Code extensions, and an updated desktop-like UI.
VMware released an open-source project for troubleshooting Kubernetes clusters. Crash Diagnostics is a tool to help investigate, analyze, and troubleshoot unresponsive or crashed Kubernetes clusters. In its first release, it can automatically collect machine state information from each node and bundle it for a human to analyze. VMware also announced the release of version 1.6 of their Enterprise PKS product. This release ships with version 1.15 of Kubernetes and adds more management features, including the Enterprise PKS Management Console and integration into the announced Tanzu Mission Control.
The CNCF made a number of announcements this week, including that they now have over 500 members, including new Platinum members Arm, NetApp, and Palo Alto Networks, and new Gold members Equinix and Fidelity Investments. More than 100 vendors now provide certified, conformant Kubernetes products, and if you'd like to work for one of them, there's a new CNCF jobs board.
Monitoring company Datadog introduced network performance monitoring this week. The product provides visibility into network flows in granular detail for every component in a cloud environment and all the connections between them, including Kubernetes pods. Datadog also announced features for distributed tracing, metrics, and two new camel-cased open-source projects, the Watermark Pod Autoscaler and the Extended Daemon Set. Their popular container report is now updated for 2019 and gives insights into the usage patterns derived from their customers.
Chaos engineering company Gremlin has added Kubernetes support to their reliability as a service platform. You can configure an attack to target a service of your choice, and the Gremlin will infer which containers it needs to eat to perform that test. Just don't feed them after midnight.
O'Reilly Media, publishers of the books with the cute animals on the front, have announced that they have acquired Katacoda, an online training and playground tool. Katacoda is popular with cloud-native vendors and powers the interactive training on Kubernetes.io.
MayaData, the sponsor of the OpenEBS project, announced a new storage engine it has donated to that project. MayaStore is built and optimized to take advantage of new NVMe storage devices and cloud volumes, and promises up to 5 times performance improvement, with tested results of more than 10 million IOPS. Learn more about OpenEBS in episode 56.
PlanetScale has announced CNDB, a fully managed cloud-native database based on Vitess and MySQL. PlanetScale was founded by members of the YouTube team who first started on what would become Vitess back in 2010.
Rancher Labs has announced that their Keys platform, also known as K3S, has gone GA, and their Rio MicroPaaS for Kubernetes has now entered beta. If you want to hear more from Rancher on these products, you can listen to episode 57.
Sysdig announced the Cloud Native Security Hub, a web platform for discovering and sharing rules and configurations for various cloud native security tools. For any given CVE or exploit, rules to detect or secure them will be published. It launched with support for the Falco product they sponsor, but will soon grow to add extra tools.
A tech preview of Pipeline 2.0, Kubernetes distribution and surf destination in Hawaii, was launched by Banzai Cloud last week. To support hybrid cloud workloads, they built a hybrid cloud controller called Cloud Fusion, which lets you act on one cluster and modify many. Banzai is hedging their bets on hybrid with 4 different ways to run hybrid clusters offered. Learn more about Pipeline in episode 59.
Canonical announced that they have added high availability clustering to their MicroKates offering and enterprise SQL database integration into their charmed Kubernetes offering. Learn more about MicroKates in episode 60.
Weaveworks announced Argo Flux, a collaboration between themselves and Intuit to combine the Argo CD and Flux CD tools. The announcement also says that AWS is helping bring Argo into EKS.
Portworx announced an update to their Portworx Enterprise Storage Management offering by adding PX Backup, a point-and-click backup solution for cloud storage, even if the company is not using Portworx for storage. Portworx also announced PX Autopilot for automatically provisioning storage for cloud-based clusters.
Pulumi announced Crosswalk for Kubernetes, a collection of open-source tools, libraries, and playbooks to help organizations adopt Kubernetes. The tools are based on Pulumi's last year working with customers to get their clusters up and running. Crosswalk includes KX, a library of extensions designed to remove some of the redundancy in using the Kubernetes API to avoid what they view as a lot of unnecessary cut-and-paste work. Pulumi also announced .NET Core support, which you will have heard hinted at in episode 76.
Snyk, with a Y, announced the release of Snyk Container, a tool for developers to help them find and fix vulnerabilities in their containerized applications. The tool scans for vulnerabilities in open source and operating system level components of applications and is a hosted product based on their open source offering.
Solo.io announced the release of version 1.0 of Glue and their Glue Enterprise product. Solo touts the enterprise and production readiness of this API gateway and points to LDAP RBAC controls and web application firewall features that are part of the release. Learn about Solo in episode 55.
Yelp has announced that their ClusterMan cluster management tool, built for managing Mesos clusters, now also manages Kubernetes clusters. They've also announced that they are open sourcing the project and have posted it to GitHub.
Interested in building secure and reliable systems? Have you read the Site Reliability Engineering book and want to know more of how it works in practice? Google Cloud has just released a preview of a new book called Building Secure Reliable Systems. It is free to download in PDF and EPUB format ahead of publication.
And now time for the Kubernetes News Lightning Round from A to Z. A10 Networks announced a blueprint for automation of the Polynimbus Secure Application Service.
Agile Stacks announced KubeFlex to aid in deploying and managing Kubernetes clusters in data centers and at the edge.
Alibaba Cloud released version Alpha 2 of their open app model.
Altinity announced their production-ready Kubernetes operator for ClickHouse data warehouses.
Aporeto launched new identity federation capabilities for Kubernetes and Istio.
Aricto announced that MiniKF is now available on the GCP marketplace.
Amazon has published a cost optimization guide for Kubernetes on AWS, offering a variety of steps you can use to cut your EKS bill.
Buoyant launched Dive, a SaaS team control plane for Kubernetes clusters.
Chronosphere added tracing capabilities.
Continuous launched a new ambassador program to reward and support Trafic community members.
Datawire announced a tool for automatic HTTPS for Kubernetes ingress in Ambassador.
DeployHub announced the release of version 9.0 of their publishing and configuration offering.
DigitalOcean announced a container registry and a Kubernetes section in their one-click apps market.
Fairwinds launched a new open source as a service platform Insights, and Astro, a product for managing monitors in a dynamic environment.
Hammerspace announced a persistent data protection offering for Kubernetes.
Humio added streaming log management capabilities to an IBM Cloud Pack.
Highscale has announced the open sourcing of their app deployment tool.
Instana added support for Rancher.
Kubler announced multi-site orchestration in Kubler 2.0 is now in private preview.
Linbit announced Piraeus Data Store, a software-defined storage offering for Kubernetes.
Maestro released a Kubernetes management tool for multi-cluster management.
Most introduced ChatOps, an open source project for real-time DevOps.
NetFoundry announced a programmable network platform for apps at the edge.
NewVector announced security policy as a code tool for Kubernetes.
NS1 expanded their suite of integrations for modern enterprise application deployment and delivery.
Opsani AI announced precision tuning for autoscalers.
Oracle announced Oracle API Gateway, Oracle Logging, and Kafka compatibility for Oracle Streaming.
Redis Labs introduced Redis Insight, a free developer and administrator tool to visually manipulate and manage data within any Redis deployment.
Rookout announced a hybrid Kubernetes debugger for DevOps teams.
SignalFX announced Kubernetes Navigator to provide AI-driven insights.
StorageOS announced the release of version 1.5.
Styra announced new features for their compliance for Kubernetes tool.
Trilio announced support for Trilio Vault on OpenShift.
Turbonomic announced Lemur, a new free observability tool for developers.
WallArm launched support for Envoy Proxy and Envoy API protection with their SaaS security product.
WhiteSource announced native integrations for all container registries.
Yugabyte has announced Yugabyte DB will be available as a self-managed database service on cross-plane Kubernetes clusters.
And finally, Zevrium has announced that their no-touch log monitoring for Kubernetes is now in private beta.
And that mammoth list, my friends, was the news from day one of KubeCon. Vicky Chung is an engineering manager with Lyft and the co-chair of KubeCon 2019 in San Diego. Prior to Lyft, she worked at Duolingo and OpenAI. Welcome to the show, Vicky.
Thanks for having me.
You've been a founding engineer a couple of times at Duolingo and then at OpenAI. What's it like to be the first engineer on a project?
It's super exciting and you get really good at being resourceful and scrappy. It's also very exciting because things move very, very fast. I feel like I'm saying all the like very cliche things here, but it is absolutely the experience.
For people like myself who may not be familiar with it, what exactly is Duolingo?
Duolingo is a language learning platform. It's for anyone to learn a second language for free. They also do certified language testing for people who want to apply to university.
Adam, I believe you are a user of Duolingo.
I've used it for a while, and I've heard that you had something to do with the naming, if not the cute owl. Is that true?
Well, the owls all are amazing designers' work. I am very not artistic, but I definitely have had a hand on our word mark.
For those that aren't familiar with what a word mark is, can you describe that?
It's the logo that has the actual name in it. I also did not know what a word mark was until our designer corrected me because I kept calling it the logo and they were like, that is not the logo.
So how did you end up designing one?
It's funny because when it first started, it had sort of like a smile on it. So it ended up looking really like the Amazon logo or word mark, whatever. And then I pointed this out to our designer. I was like, I think it looks like Amazon. So anyway, that's why the word mark no longer smiles.
Vicky, have you learned any languages through Duolingo?
Yeah, I extensively went through their Spanish tree multiple times as I was developing it. So
perhaps you can share a tip with me, which is if I've gone through a certain part of the tree, but then I've lapsed in my playing of it, so then it regresses you back that you have to kind of earn your way back up to where you are. Is there any quick way to get back to where you were?
There's no cheating out of learning. The algorithm thinks you've forgotten.
I'm looking for the test out button. Where can I prove that I know this already?
I mean, I think there is a test out button, but you just have to convince the computer that you still know these things.
When did you get involved with Kubernetes?
It was pretty early on. So I was the first engineer at OpenAI. So when I joined, there wasn't really like much of anything. There wasn't even an office. I had no laptop. I had to build the infrastructure from scratch, essentially, before all our researchers started. And we settled on building it on top of Kubernetes. At the time, it was like sort of a bold decision, maybe, because I think Kubernetes was either like 1.0 or 1.1. So we weren't like, you know, super early like beta adopters, but it was definitely like not clear that it was going to be the standard. There were a lot of rough edges, but it ended up being, I think, the correct choice for us.
Were there any considerations about the fact that you were building out the machine learning platform and that would have been relatively untested on Kubernetes at the time?
Oh, for sure. We got a lot of questions all the time because it was pretty clear as we were going along and building this platform that we were doing things that Kubernetes wasn't built to do, or at least at the time it wasn't. I think, you know, nowadays there's a lot more community support behind it as like a machine learning platform. But at the time, it was really built for like cloud native microservices, not so much for these batch use cases. So we would like start doing things that the platform clearly didn't want to do. And so we would have to like customize or do some work around to make it work. And then our researchers would be like, maybe we should use another platform. And so we were pretty like open-minded. We would go and evaluate what's on the market at the time. And then every time we would sort of come back to like, yeah, Kubernetes is probably the one we should stick with.
As the team assembling the infrastructure for a group of researchers, what did you have to do in order to make sure that you were building a platform that was suitable for the work that they would do on top of that platform?
Many mistakes were made. We would build things and we thought we knew what the researchers wanted, but obviously that's wrong because how could we know? So it's a classic case of engineers building things thinking that we know better than the users, and we really didn't. So many mistakes were made. We sort of learned along the way to tighten the feedback loop. So I spent quite a lot of time actually just sitting with our researchers and shadowing them and seeing like what it is that they actually do and doing a little bit more incremental changes to their workflows to adapt to using the Kubernetes platform rather than like, oh, here's a whole new world and here's your new workflow and trying to replace everything they were used to.
Sounds like there were some great takeaways from that. If you were to run into a similar project where you're essentially building up infrastructure for a number of other users, what would you take away from that experience in terms of to do differently?
I think I would spend a lot more time just sitting with the user and just listening and not doing anything, just watching and observing and listening. Maybe that's obvious for people who are more used to like user experience research, but I think as an engineer and we sort of saw researchers as also tech-savvy engineers of like a different type. And so we thought we understood a lot what their use cases were. So yeah, definitely assume less and listen more.
2 years ago, you joined Lyft and you now run the compute team that manages Kubernetes. What has the experience been like at Lyft?
The experience has been great. It's very different coming from OpenAI. OpenAI was a research lab run like a startup, I guess is the best way to put it. Lyft is more of a traditional like tech company. So I think processes and like scale wise is a little bit different. But I really enjoyed it because, you know, Lyft was pretty established already 2 years ago, but we had this opportunity to rebuild essentially the foundation of their infrastructure using Kubernetes. So this isn't an opportunity that comes up very often where you go to a big place that already is running all these things at scale. But now you get to re-architect how it all works.
Can you describe how the Lyft infrastructure has changed over those 2 years?
Before I joined Lyft, none of our production stuff was running on containers. And so we're an AWS shop and everything was sort of like running directly on AWS. And we ran into a lot of challenges, especially as we grew in the number of microservices we were operating. So this is sort of, I think, a classic problem of why people start considering containers. is because as you have like hundreds of microservices, you want to make sure that the infrastructure team can continue to provide a good basis for running these services while the service teams can continue to be productive within the layers of their stack. So when I came in, we were just starting to evaluate Kubernetes, and that's what we've been doing. And now we have production stuff running on Kubernetes. And I guess that's where we're so far.
The things that you're describing remind me a lot of the challenges that many large organizations are facing today about an existing set of infrastructure, looking at essentially replatforming into containers and Kubernetes. How did you go about picking which things you start with? I mean, there's so many different running services and machines. How do you eat that elephant, so to speak?
We actually started with all of our batch and machine learning workloads. I mean, partially, I'm most experienced with those, but another reason is because I think they have this great attribute of sort of things being a lot more episodic, if that makes sense. You know, you spin off a batch workload or like a job or like an experiment, and then it's a lot easier to say, okay, for my next batch of experiments, I'm going to run it on the new platform instead, rather than for something that's long-running service that's serving production traffic to have to shift over to a platform slowly. So it was just a lot easier to iterate on the batch side of things.
We spoke to your colleague Matt Klein in episode 33, who started the Envoy project while working at Lyft. What can you tell us about being a user of Envoy inside Lyft?
There's a lot of engineering practices that's deeply integrated with our Envoy stack. In particular, like in relation to our migration to Kubernetes, it's been a big help because all of our services were already using Envoy. So we didn't have to like move them to a service mesh or move them to like some other networking technology on Kubernetes. We could just be pretty much transparent to the services. You're using Envoy and your old stack. We're going to lift and shift you into a container and continue to use Envoy as the proxy going out.
When you say lift and shift, do you spell them both with a Y?
That would have been a good tagline.
Craig, you missed your calling in copywriting. You've worked on some really exciting technologies, especially a lot of AI work. And despite that, you've really chosen to focus yourself on infrastructure, which is not often seen as the, you know, hot and exciting area, though certainly it's super critical. What made you decide to focus on infrastructure?
I think initially, I guess one thing about being the first engineer in all these projects, sort of going back to the earlier question, is you really learn to do whatever it takes to get the job done. So you learn to be like extremely flexible with your skill set. So I guess in that sense, since I was the first engineer at OpenAI, even though I wasn't an infrastructure engineer before, I essentially stumbled into becoming an infrastructure engineer because that was the thing that we needed. And that's actually why I've stuck with it since then, is because of this realization that everyone needs infrastructure. Even if the cloud is providing all these managed services or whatnot, everyone needs infrastructure to even get off the ground or get started. And it was that realization that like, oh, if I'm an infrastructure, I can enable all these things. I could go from OpenAI to Lyft, you know, two very different companies, but my skills would still be applicable here. And I find that very empowering, I guess.
You were the co-chair of this week's KubeCon event in San Diego. What has that involved for you so far?
The responsibilities really start in the beginning of thinking through what the trends or the themes are. So Brian Lyles, my other co-chair, and I will go through all the proposals. And well, I guess even before that, we select the program committee to score all these proposals. So usually they come from our open source maintainers or past speakers, and we make sure we have good representation in our program committee. And then once the committee has scored all the proposals, then Brian and I go through them and take a look at what the trends are and what the tracks should be. Usually we have already established tracks for this conference, but most of what we do is looking at which tracks are going to be popular or relevant this year. And then we decide which talks to accept. That's sort of like the first phase. And then the second phase of that is really like right now ramping up to the conference, making sure that all the content is going to resonate with the audience and prepping for our own talks. So,
how do you decide on when topic areas are getting interesting enough and there's enough interest in them to start creating a separate track. Because, you know, it started out with Kubernetes, and obviously there's so many more projects that have come out and so many things that people have interest in. When does that interest grow large enough that you decide, hey, we really need a separate track to talk about this?
I think some of it is informed by our own experiences working closely with these technologies. And some of it comes from seeing what people are submitting to the conference, seeing the variety of use cases that are out there in the wild. So yeah, I think, for example, we can see the evolution of the community from even a few years ago, or even like 2 years ago till now, really maturing of use cases or exploring of more sophisticated or enterprise use cases. That's really driving, for example, a lot of talks in operations at scale, or driving more talks in security or developer environments for larger teams.
How much leeway do you have to let your own personality and preferences shine through in this role, rather than just representing the audience? Are there any things that you did to try and make KubeCon a conference that you personally would like to attend?
Yeah, I think the conference itself, year after year, it gets more and more competitive. So there's just a lot of good talks that we get that we may not necessarily be able to accept. So it is very hard, I think, sometimes to like make that decision. Obviously, my personal bias goes in, right? When we get a lot of talks in the first top 50, they're all really good and we have to pick 10. I can't say that it's all based on what I want to see. It's all informed by, first and foremost, the program committee. But after that, I definitely do see like, okay, these talks are all interesting, but I would personally think this is more useful or more relevant this year.
What would you say you learned along the way?
There's a lot of research that I did, I guess, into other CNCF projects. I'm exposed to a number of them just through my work or my daily life, but the ecosystem is expanding at this crazy rate that sometimes I find it hard to keep up if I'm not actively trying. So definitely, as I see these talks into areas that I may not have to touch at Lyft, I need to go do some research to understand what it is that people are doing with these technologies.
In that research, what have you found has changed about KubeCon over the years?
I think there are a few things. The ones that really stick out to me are, there's a lot about developer productivity. I think as more companies move to cloud-native microservices architecture, there's really this, to me, unsolved problem of how do we keep people developing as seamlessly as they used to with, you know, this one monolithic Flask application that you can run on your laptop and you can like iterate very quickly and use the debugger. It's a very smooth experience, I guess, and that's largely not replicated when we move to running hundreds of microservices in the cloud. So there's quite a few projects that I'm excited about that I think we'll see at KubeCon with several talks about how to evolve our developer experience as well to keep up with the trends. Another thing that I learned quite a bit about is sort of what larger enterprises do with security and governance, and also like how to scale that with the new architecture.
What are you most excited about for this KubeCon?
I'm excited to see all the use cases coming to maturity. I think this is really a trend that we've been seeing, but like this is the first time that I'm seeing very traditional enterprises adopting this technology, and maybe like banks and stuff like that, that those are not tech companies. They're using this technology in production. I find that sort of is a moment for the community to be like, all right, this technology is ready for the big stage now. I'm very excited to see that coming.
You're certainly not a passive observer of this KubeCon. You're the co-chair of it. So what are you personally most proud of in terms of the impact that you've had on it?
I think Brian and I both care a lot about diversity in the community. So I'm very happy to sort of have a hand in even just like influencing little things that we do to make the community more inclusive. I guess one small thing we did was for all the program committees, one, make sure that their time is being rewarded by CNCF, and also to sort of giving people the option to donate tickets to the diversity scholarship. Those are things that I think I've gotten really positive feedback from other people who are going to the conference that I'm very, very happy about.
We can tell that you're obviously very happy to work with your co-chair, Brian, and we very much enjoyed the conversation that we had with him before the last KubeCon in Barcelona. What would you say you've learned from Brian?
Brian is a lot more experienced these technologies and this community than I am. I think just that I work in more of an end user company versus he's more involved in like the upstream community, that I really like that we can sort of share our different perspectives on where we see the technology going. He can see more upfront and up close to who the people are in the community and what are they doing and where it's all going, versus me, I'm like, these are my needs right now and I want to see these things in the community. So we're sort of coming from like different ends of the spectrum, and I really like that difference.
What things have you learned along the way that will be advice you pass on to your co-chair for the next conference?
I think the one thing that I feel like I learned along the way that would be good to have started from the beginning is looking for the unexpected content. I think there's, if you can see what I see, which is like a long list of talks that are rated with some scores by a committee, and they're all ranked, sort of like sorted in this long list. You'll find that the top are usually all the sort of like trending or popular talks. And then there are some more like divisive talks in terms of the scoring because they're more like niche or maybe more unexpected or surprising. So sometimes I like to sort of mix it up a little bit and look at those talks that are maybe not necessarily like the top of the top, but look down a little bit for the more unexpected ones. And there might be gems there. So that's sort of the advice I would give.
As you look forward to the next KubeCon, what would you like to see change? And what have you learned that you would kind of apply to that?
I think it's getting harder and harder to get into KubeCon because there are more and more projects in CNCF that it's hard to get them all covered, I guess. So one thing I'm really excited to see is this idea of Kubernetes Days by CNCF, which is the smaller version of KubeCon that's more regional. And I think that will allow us to sort of funnel more talks to the community without rejecting them to like KubeCon. They'll still get their chance to shine within the community. And so hopefully I want to see sort of more diversity in topics in KubeCon. And then the ones that are like more specific topics that are really popular, we can do things like Kubernetes Days to address those hot topics, if that makes sense. I think historically, we haven't had a lot of necessarily like deep dives into technology and KubeCon, just because Kubernetes was still like relatively young or relatively new. So a lot of the audience was just dipping their toes into the technology. But now that more and more people are adopting this in production, there's actually a lot more sophisticated use cases. And I like to see talks that are doing like really deep dives. They're maybe catered to more advanced or power users of this technology, so they can have good takeaways from the conference as well.
Vicky, thank you so much for joining us at this busy time.
Thank you for having me.
You can find Vicky on Twitter at VMCHEUNG, as well as in the keynotes over the next few days. Thanks for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you're just listening online, please subscribe. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod, or you can reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website, KubernetesPodcast.com, where you'll find transcripts and show notes.
A lot of show notes.
Indeed. Until next time, take care.
See you next week.